Hello, and a warm welcome to this Respiratory Futures podcast. I have the pleasure of being joined today on a sunny afternoon in Oxford by Professor John Stradling, Emeritus Professor of Respiratory Medicine at the University of Oxford. Dr. Robert Kaufman, a GP at the Binfield practice in Berkshire with a special interest in ENT, and Dr. Ian Smith, Consultant Chest Physician and Director of the Royal Papworth Respiratory Support and Sleep Centre. Our guests will be talking about GP screening for obstructive sleep apnea. This is a new approach which has the potential to significantly improve detection rates and waiting times, so I'm excited to hear more. Professor John Stradling will be sharing the discussion. Over to you, John.
Thank you very much. We've got round the table Ian and Robert, and perhaps you'd like to introduce really what sort of service you're currently running.
My name's Ian Smith. I work at Papworth Hospital, and we have a sleep laboratory there that's been set up for more than 20 years. And we have a full range of services in the hospital. We have polysomnography, looking at respiratory and non-respiratory sleep problems, problems like narcolepsy. But then we have a very large population of patients with sleep apnea, which is largely what we're talking about today. We have about 11,000 patients on treatment, and we see about 1,600 new patients for treatment every year.
Mm. And Robert?
I'm Robert Kaufman. I'm a GP in East Berkshire, a place called Binfield, and I have been running ENT services there for the last 20 years for two CCGs, and also since 2007 have been running a sleep service, initially just seeing patients and screening them, and since 2009 have been doing home sleep studies using the grey flash and black flash which Oxford use.
Excellent. And I'm John Stradling. I ran the Oxford Sleep Clinic until a few years ago, and Dr. Annabel Nicol now does that, but I've been continuing in research and have a particular interest in trying to improve services for people with sleep apnea. So I think today what we're really interested in is that because of the enormous increase in the prevalence and recognition of sleep apnea, most sleep centres are now completely overloaded and finding they cannot cope with the workload. And in some ways, this is a little bit like has occurred with hypertension over the last 20, 30 years, when initially hypertension was a rare diagnosis managed in hospital, and now it's nearly entirely managed by general practitioners. And I think in some ways, it's possible that sleep apnea is going to move in that direction. So the question we're asking today is really, can sleep apnea be diagnosed, and what sort of models exist? What sort of models might we want to see existing? What are the pros and cons? And indeed, as we've discovered in Oxford, perhaps what models don't work? So perhaps I should first of all admit that the Oxford attempt with the Whitney GPs to run a home screening service worked well to start with, but then fell when we tried to expand it to more GP surgeries. There were too many disparate views and a feeling by the CCG that it would simply open the floodgates. So it's quite difficult to introduce a service, and that's why we've got two people here today who've managed to introduce good services. So perhaps it might be worth starting with you, Robert, to explain the evolution and the history of the sleep service that you're now providing very successfully.
So initially in 2006, I think it was, the local trust, which was Wexham and Heatherwood Trust in those days, their sleep service had disappeared for some reason. I have no idea why. And the local CCG, because of my ENT experience, asked me to go through 200 sets of notes that were sitting on someone's desk where these people were waiting to be seen in a sleep clinic. So having gone through all those notes, I think it was only about 10% I felt needed actually to be seen because the referrals were so bad. And then they asked me to take on the mantle of seeing these people. And so that's how we started off, just seeing the patients, doing a normal screening, an Epworth sleep study, and if I felt they needed a sleep study, referring them on to John in Oxford in those days. Then we had a sort of blue sky moment, and I came and discussed it with John about doing home sleep studies, and that was, we started that in 2009.
Gosh, that long.
Yeah, absolutely. We both aged. So I bought some machines. So initially it was 8 grey flash machines, and started seeing people and at the same time doing their sleep studies if felt appropriate, downloading the studies, looking at the studies, and if they had OSA or anything like that, then to email the study across to John and his team, who would then decide whether they need to be referred or not. So I now do all of that for 350,000 people. By the beginning of this year, I'd seen 1,768 people, 1,636 studies done, and of that, 710 patients were referred for CPAP, which is equivalent to 43%, which I think is pretty equal to hospital rates of transfer to people who need CPAP.
Clearly, this has been a major effort for you, and you've put a lot of work and effort into this, and not necessarily all GPs would want to do it to this kind of level. What kind of training do you think would be required if somebody wanted to copy or mimic your service? Because clearly you had an ENT background already, but many GPs wouldn't have an ENT background. So what do you think they ought to do to get up to speed and contemplate running a service like this?
I think it depends what you're going to do. If you're going to do a sleep study like we do with the black flash or grey flash, or if you're just going to do pulse oximetry, which I'm sure Ian's going to talk about later, as to what is needed experience-wise. And I think that you can probably teach most people how to do an Epworth score, do their weight, their height, all that sort of stuff, take a history. You would have to find a GP who's actually got an interest in it. Whether you would even need a GP, you may be able to train a nurse in the community to do these things. Because the main thing is to get the sleep study, and they wouldn't even have to, I suppose, look at it. They could then send it to the local hospital for them to, like you had in your Oxford ones, that they can look at it and decide whether the patient needs to be seen.
I mean, there are clearly grades of involvement, and in a sense, yours is one end of a spectrum.
Yes.
And then at the other end of the spectrum is perhaps just doing screening on the basis of questionnaires like the Stop Bang and the ESS and working entirely from that. And then everything in between. And I think Ian's service is in a sense in between yours and just using questionnaires. Clearly GPs aren't going to do this unless there's a reward for doing it. So they've got to design a service which is cost effective. And do you get any help? Do you get healthcare assistant help, or do you do absolutely everything yourself?
I stopped doing everything myself after the first bit because I didn't have the time. My secretary obviously does the meet and greet and does the weight and the height and the blood pressure and so on. She's very, very good at that. And then I actually have someone else who downloads it now as well, because that's what takes the time, obviously, as much as anything else. So basically, I'm seeing the patients. They have a 20-minute appointment. They then go off to Jan, my secretary. She then shows them how to use the machine. They then go home, obviously post it back or drop it back. It depends where they live. And then I actually phone the patient with the result. I don't see them again. So they don't need to be seen more than once. So they get a phone call or even a text now to say it was either, you know, I'm going to be referring you to Oxford or not, etc.
So it should be quite easy to cost up what that service costs you, and therefore
yes,
how it might compare with a CCG going on sending the patient to their nearest sleep clinic or whatever.
Yes, absolutely.
Obviously also remembering that it's a lot more convenient for the patient, not just potentially a cost saving.
Okay. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Ian, your service is clearly different. Can you go through the history of how this all came about?
So I'm a chest physician primarily, but moved more and more into the sleep world, and the prevalence in the community and the awareness of it, of sleep apnea, has enormously increased over the years that I've been in practice. And we started with a service that was purely hospital-based, that every patient came to the hospital. But in East Anglia, as in a lot of the country, our population is pretty thinly spread, and they're not particularly good roads, and so journey times become an issue for the patients. The first change we made was to have outreach clinics so that we went out to clinics to save the patients the problem of travelling. But even with the outreach clinics, it's difficult to cover the region. And so we approached some of our local GPs. And actually, a bit like you, Robert, that we had one local champion who, disappointingly, was only up the road from us. He didn't save that much in terms of journey times, but he was a real champion with the CCG to say, look, we can do it in Huntingdon, why don't we do it in Ely, and why don't we do it more widely in East Anglia? And so with his help, we went to the CCG and said, well, why don't we have a model where potentially we keep the best of all worlds, where we have GPs with an interest who store the kit for us. So we don't have complex respiratory polygraphy study in the community. We use oximetry, and the patients are referred to one of our hubs where they have the equipment, and they are issued with that, take it home, they fill out a questionnaire. The questionnaire is fairly basic. It includes the Epworth Sleepiness Scale score, but also other questions to validate that, because the raw score is a very good population tool, but if you're trying to diagnose the patient in front of you, you'll miss people. So there are questions about whether they're just generally sleepy, because one person's sleepy on the Epworth score is another person's normal.
So you don't just look at the Epworth sleepiness score as a measure of symptoms. It's much more of an integrated questionnaire tool that you use to go with the oximetry.
Yes. And so the patient does the oximetry. We are sent the results and we interpret the study and the oximetry result and the questionnaire in the context of the patient. And about a quarter to a third of patients, we can say they don't have an important diagnosis of sleep apnea, that there's nothing to see on the study. They're not sleepy. And whatever it is that's being observed, pauses in breathing at night, is normal, because it is normal in a large proportion of
people. So about 25% are spared
don't have to come to hospital. And because it's out of tariff, that's a very good deal for the CCG because the whole thing is done for about £80. And that compares to the hospital episode and a new patient appointment, which would be considerably more than that. But then about 50-55% of patients will have obvious obstructive sleep apnea on this study and appropriate symptoms that you would want to treat. And we'd bring them into a clinic, which is often run by one of our nurse specialists, to discuss the treatment options, get the patient consent to start treatment, and they come back to start treatment. And that can all be done in about 3 weeks.
Okay, but they don't need another sleep study. You're happy with the combination of the oximetry and the
Where there's obvious sleep apnea on oximetry and there are no confounding factors, there's no suggestion they've got heart failure or they've recently had a stroke, something that might mean they had central sleep apnea instead of obstructive, we wouldn't do another study. And I guess the proof of the pudding there is our take-up rate of CPAP and compliance is around 85%, and we repeat studies after they've been put on treatment and they get better. And if they don't, then we put them through more complex studies. So it's about a third at the moment, but our ambition is to keep pushing at that door to try to increase it. And there are a number of approaches to that. One of them, we got a grant, fortunately, from the European Union to look at our service and to examine where it's distributed around the whole of East Anglia. It's primarily based in the CCG that we're based in, but that's actually the second largest CCG in the country. So that gives you an idea of the scale of some of the problems. But the project that we're being funded to look at is where are our patients, the patients we know about, where is our resource, and is that in the best place? And then to look beyond that at where would we expect the patients to come from?
So this is just matching geography and need and
trying to improve on what we're doing, because at the moment, we're fantastically grateful, this has depended to an extent on the interest and the goodwill of the GPs. It's not a fantastic financial deal for them.
And the proportion, presumably, therefore, who take up CPAP and stay on it.
Yes.
So there's no evidence that it's led to an increase in people who didn't really need to be screened.
Not in our practice. So well, I think that's important. Good. I do worry that one of the problems with sleep apnea is that in a proportion of the population, it's normal and it isn't an illness. Mm. And if we go on too much of a crusade to find people, we'll find an awful lot of people who we will make worried and we'll make them ill and we'll give them a treatment that won't do them any good.
Yeah.
And that would be counterproductive.
Robert, in terms of your service, what have been the downsides that you might want to reassure colleagues can be overcome, or maybe there weren't any?
I think the downsides are always the battle with the CCGs. We always wage war with them and we win some battles and, you know, for a few years. And then it comes up again, and as you said, they come to you and they ask you for this data and that data to see whether, and we have to just keep doing that. But sleep I find very rewarding. I think you're dealing with generally nice patients. A lot of them are keen, or their partners are often the ones who are keen for them to be treated.
So if you were a new GP thinking, this is the way I'd like to go, what are the key things which they are going to have to convince their CCG over? We've heard one index and some information that the hit rates, by which I mean the CPAP take-up rates, are no worse, i.e. we're not wasting resources on the worried well. That's clearly an important index, and information on that they'll need. What other information? They presumably need things like how much the local sleep clinic charges and how many they might see. And so there's a sort of battery of data they're going to have to put together as part of the CCG persuasion process.
I think the big one also is just public health with regard to, you know, a lot of these people are obese. So there's all diabetes, as we've said, diabetes, hypertension, is trying to improve their general health, which is what we're trying to do in the great scheme of things. So, yes, I think that often what they need to do is just go to Ian or come to me or whatever and get our model, and that's what they take.
I've always felt that it's much better to do it in conjunction with the local sleep clinic rather than in competition with the local sleep clinic.
I think it's always been the case, which is why I came to you in the first place. For people to do it out there on their own is always a risk, just clinical governance-wise, everything-wise. You have to have that link with the local service, so you've got someone to talk to. You can't be out there on your own.
Because I know in one centre that the hospital has not supported this process because of loss of income. and they've actively tried to persuade their sleep physicians not to be involved and lose this business, which is crazy because in my view, they're going to be more likely to make up for that loss of business by increased referrals to do what they really do well, which is to put people on CPAP. So it's a spacious argument in my view.
Absolutely, yes. I think if it's obvious, it's obvious. We would only repeat studies where they were borderline or there were technical problems. And they're not very many that require that.
And I think it's encouraging that somebody as expert as you is prepared to say that with appropriate engagement of the brain, oximetry can solve quite a lot of problems. It's not perfect. It has limitations. But certainly as a tool for a GP that's not very techie, it's very easy to use. Then there's a new wave of oximeters that can report to the cloud, so you don't even need to worry about using emails or that kind of stuff. And so I think the technology is getting better and better for allowing GPs to do easy sleep studies and getting that data across if that's what they want to do. So what sort of model? Do you think there could be a national model, or is it always going to be a case by case, do you think, Ian?
I think that finding solutions that fit the interests and the expertise and the strengths of different practices is the key. And having a suite of solutions, which can be all to the good of the patients. You can do these things at a distance in different ways. I think that potentially the right way to go would be to have some guidance on what is good practice. I think that actually we provide an almost ridiculous positivity rate compared to almost everything else we do. If you think how many times the GPs check the thyroid function and the hemoglobin and it comes back normal and nobody cares, because that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. If you had a 60% hit rate for a blood test, you'd think I'm probably not doing enough of them. But I think that is the level at which a lot of services are working, and that's probably a benchmark. So if we had a list of what we thought were good outcomes and then give that to a local area and say, are you getting that outcome from the service that you have? This is a reasonable level of service. And if the answer is no, then to say, well, look, here are some solutions. And they may go outside the health service. I mean, there are plenty of private companies. Now, we have always worked on the principle, well, but they must be taking a cut and we must be able to do it better and cheaper. But if you're somewhere where there isn't a sleep service, then that may be the way that you deliver. One of the cornerstones of how we push sleep services and the diagnosis of sleep apnea, and isn't it a wonderful thing, is that the economic analysis shows that it's wonderful in terms of compared to most things that we do in the health service, it actually pays you back. It's free after 7 years of starting somebody on treatment. You're saving the health service money. What a marvelous thing. The one thing that was missing from one of the big things missing from the analysis was how you diagnosed that patient. Mm. And if you have a ridiculously expensive and wasteful system for diagnosing people, you undermine that whole argument.
But Robert, you pointed out that the workload that GPs have now is pretty maximal. And even if they might want to take this on, they just simply haven't got the capacity. So a design that means that as much as possible is done by non-GPs, i.e. the support, and you've described how you have somebody doing the booking in and downloading the data and presenting it in a way which minimizes the time you have to spend. I guess any system that's designed should work along those lines, where actually non-GPs do the bulk of the job and the GP input is at the clinical decision-making process, having got everything else done for them. One of the things we've discussed is whether there is the enthusiasm with GPs to do this when they've got so much else on their plates. And you mentioned earlier, Robert, the satisfaction gained from recognizing and treating these patients. It's very cost effective and it's a big reward. But Ian, if you were talking to a GP and trying to persuade them to start a service like this, what are the key points you would want to enthuse them with?
So I think that in trying to encourage people to do things that that we think are the right thing to do, I think there's an increasing literature in the psychology of this, is that the CCG chiding them and threatening them is very unlikely to work. Even offering financial rewards is less effective than you think. And actually nudging, there's this term of nudging, of just putting it in people's minds with this sort of publicity that this is the right thing to do, and then you make it easy. So it's easy to do good things that are easy to do. And so the easier you make it, so, you know, I think that's part of the reason our system has worked, is that we say to the GP, look, we'll buy the kit, we'll give it to you, we'll teach your band three nurses what to do with it, and all you need to do is to host it. You don't even need to see the patients. And it all gets sent to us, and it's easy for us to do because we've distilled the information we want. We're not reading a long rambling letter. We've got the information we need. We've got the oximetry test that we understand. So it's easy for us, it's easy for the GP, it's easy for the patient. And I think there's an awful lot of strength in that argument. If you make it easy and you put it in people's minds, well, look at all the good you could do, then it's much more likely to happen than if you try to put in a complex system that is perfect. I would much rather see a group of people who are rather roughly worked up and sorted out than always see someone with sleep apnea and have nothing to do.
I entirely agree. My wife, who's a retired GP, says there's no point presenting a problem to a GP unless you give them the solution at the same time,
yeah,
which is essentially what you're saying. It has to be a complete package and make it very easy, and quite reasonably so, in my view.
And I think I've mentioned this project that we're doing, the Track and Know project with European funding, which is where I hope that we will come up with some robust tools to identify hotspots where we expect there to be a lot of patients. But then to look at, so where would be the best places to have services, and then to offer to them, look, here's a package. This would be very straightforward for you to implement. This is how it could be done. Because we know that treating people with sleep apnea can do so much good, screening them is a step on the way to finding them. And I've had this conversation with our local CCG. They were worried that we were overperforming in sleep services. And my analogy was, and are we overperforming in vaccinations? And nobody would ever question. If you had 99% vaccination rate, you would be congratulated as a super high performing CCG. And our CCG are now very happy to tell other CCGs and anybody who asks them that they're a super high performing sleep apnea CCG because they're finding people and treating them. And that has long-term health benefits. So putting it out there as a badge of honor to say our GP supercluster or whatever can badge itself as a leading center that delivers this. But actually, it's a fairly easy thing to achieve, and it does an awful lot of good.
Excellent. Yes, I agree with all that.
In a lot of ways, what you do is much more sellable than what I do with regard to being out there in the community. Mine is probably more of an intermediate service, I suppose you would say, rather than something that everyone could do. Because, as you say, it's not the GP's not actually having to do much. They're hosting it for you. The problem, only problem with that is you need, obviously, the local hospitals, consultants, to buy into it completely. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
Sure.
And I think, so you've got two battles there, haven't you?
Two opportunities.
Two opportunities.
It might be worth pointing out at this stage that the OSA Partnership website has a section on what GPs might do in terms of setting up a sleep service, and it describes Ian's service, it describes Robert's service, and Tamina Siddiqui's service at Milton Keynes, and to some extent ours, as it was. So there is further information. There are other resources. There are other websites which a GP could use if they were trying to put together an argument for starting such a service, or indeed a CCG starting an argument to try and persuade its GPs to take part in a service. So we would commend people to read that if they're interested.
I do think that if a GP was really interested to come and meet with some of us, the people who are championing this, and to just spend a day in the service and say, this is how it works. These are the things that we've overcome. These are the solutions we've come up with. But also to get the feel, I think you were saying how rewarding it can be. And I think that can't be overstated. So we've got a test that picks up a huge number of people who need help. And then we have help. We have a treatment that really works. And they come back and they're just full of gratitude because whatever all the numbers say, they feel $1 million. To be involved in that service, to actually do what we're trained to do and find a problem and solve it for patients is a fantastic thing to do.
It's what we're here for.
Yeah.
Absolutely.